You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Throughout history, there have been stories of dolls that were dangerous. Sometimes such tales come from voodoo legends, or from TV shows like The Twilight Zone or Night Gallery, or from films like Child's Play. A few strange occurrences can turn a child's plaything into an object of terror, changing a trusted doll into a totem of fear. Let me tell you a story, and while you may find it hard to believe, the following story is true. The story took place just a few years ago. There's a little girl, we're going to call her M. M was a child who loved to play with her dolls, but she was also very creative and liked to decorate her dolls with paint and markers. Now in her mind, she was just having fun, but it bothers her parents to see her dolls transformed into garishly painted and occasionally dismembered creatures. One day, they found her favorite doll with its hair cut and permanent marker stains on its face. It was missing a leg. Her parents wanted to teach her a lesson, to teach her not to mistreat her toys, so they told her she needed to apologize to the doll. Reluctantly, she did so, but then came the hard part. They told her she had to throw the doll away. She didn't want to do it, but they were insistent and made her take it to the trash can and put it inside. Later that day, her parents took the trash out to the street for pickup. The next day, M woke up to find that her doll was back, lying on the floor of her room. Her parents found her there holding the doll and accused her of getting it out of the trash can. "The trash is dirty and it can make you sick," they told her. "We know you like the doll, but it needs to go away." So, back into the trash it went. And this time, M's father took the doll himself and put it in a trash bag while the girl watched. And then, he took the bag out to the bin and dropped it into the bottom of the can. "You need to stay out of the trash. You've said goodbye to your doll," he chided her. "Don't let me catch you out here trying to get her back." Now, M denied having touched the trash, but she agreed that she would not do so. But the next day, the doll was back. And this time, it was in the girl's bed when she woke up. She screamed, and her parents came running into the room. Her mother asked the girl why she'd gotten the doll out of the trash, but she said she hadn't. "Oh, we want to believe you, honey, but dolls don't climb out of the trash," they told her. Yet she was insistent. She hadn't touched the trash. The doll must have come back on its own. So the father and the daughter put the doll into a plastic bag, and together they drove more than a mile away, where the little girl watched as he threw the bag into a dumpster. "This should solve the problem," he said, and they went home. A few days later, the whole family was planning to take a road trip, and as they were preparing to leave, taking their bags out to the car and loading up to go, the parents heard a scream. when they went to the car, there, sitting in the car seat, was the doll. Everyone was shaken up by this, but M's father insisted there had to be a logical explanation. Still, everyone was a little relieved as they watched him place the doll into the trash yet again before they all got into their car and drove off on vacation. The trip was uneventful. They arrived at their hotel, they got room keys for two rooms with a connecting door, and the father went to park the car while the rest of the family made their way up to the new rooms, where they found the doll sitting on the bed as if it were waiting for them. When this story began, I assured you it was true, and it is a true story. That little girl was my daughter, and the terrible, terrible, asshole prankster who kept putting the doll back was me. Coming up next, demonic dolls.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk. I'm Karen Stoltzner.
And I'm Blake Smith.
Demonic dolls, devil dolls, monster dolls, creepy dolls. Call them what you want, but the history of dolls that people have seen as monstrous is quite long and full of frightening stories of the type that will make your hair stand up on end and give you goose flesh. I'm quite fond of the episodes of Twilight Zone that feature scary dolls or of Night Gallery. Movies like Child's Play and the movie Magic fit this motif as well, but many of these tales aren't considered pure fiction. The self-proclaimed demonologists Ed and Lorraine Warren keep an allegedly cursed Raggedy Ann doll called Annabelle in their home museum and claim that the doll has led to deaths. Voodoo dolls are alleged to help enable magic spells. The Hexham Heads, while seeming to be mundane in origin, somehow are alleged to have inspired lycanthropic activity. But perhaps no allegedly evil doll is more famous than Robert the Doll. There are links to some of the stories about Robert in our show notes at monstertalk.org, and there have been books and movies made about him as well. Countless TV shows have shown the doll, and legends gather around Robert like spiderwebs in an attic corner. As you might guess, I'm a fan of other podcasts, and the very popular show called Lore covered Robert in episode 15. I enjoy lore, although the host, Aaron Mankey, has different purposes in mind for his show than I do. He does tell a good story, and I think that episode gives you a good feel for what people might be thinking when they go to see Robert the Doll for the first time. A link to that episode of Lore is in our show notes at monstertalk.org, along with other fascinating connections. Let's get to our interview now, but stick around because I want to do a little bit more talking about Robert after we've heard from his curator, Dr. Corey Convertito.
Monster Talk.
Dr. Corey Convertito has a PhD in maritime history, focusing on the 18th century British naval history. Corey is the curator of the Key West Art and Historical Society, which oversees the Fort East Martello Museum, which is the home of Robert the Doll. So welcome to the show, Corey.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I bet this time of year you get a lot of questions about Robert.
Actually, all year long, we get questions okay. about Robert. This time of year, yeah, with Halloween, and it's also his birthday this month. So I think that.
Oh, how old is he now?
Adds to it. He's 112. 112.
Wow. I heard that he received a letter from George Bush when he turned 100. Is that true?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Both President Bush, and then he also got one. I think it was the year or two later when Jeb Bush was governor of Florida. He got one for his birthday as well.
Wow, famous guy.
Well, they probably thought they were writing Bob Dole. Could you tell us the story of Robert the Doll and why he's so famous?
I guess we can start with what he is, and then I guess how he came to be here. Robert is a Steiff doll. It's a German doll company that's been around. I think they were established a little bit earlier than Robert was fabricated. They're famous. They've made the first teddy bear for Teddy Roosevelt, so they're quite well known, and their production, like their dolls are and bears are quite valuable. Mm-hmm. So he was made and brought to the U.S. There was a family that lived in Key West called the Otto family. They were a multi-generational family that lived on the island, and they were of Prussian descent. And Steiff being in present-day Germany, there's the connection between the family and the area where Robert was made. And so a family member of the Otto family actually bought the doll for a young boy named Robert Eugene Otto, who lived in Key West, and his dad was a doctor. His grandparents owned a pharmacy here. So they were quite prominent family in town. They were very well-off family, and their young son came to have this doll in 1904. And the doll and the boy were inseparable for years. He, you know, the doll is quite large. It was life size. It would put in close to Robert Eugene Otto, the living boy size, when he received him. And they were just really inseparable. The family remembers Robert bringing the doll around with him, taking him where he went, talking to him. And the story goes that Robert, the boy, would blame Robert the doll for things that Robert the boy had done wrong. And so this transference possibly created some kind of energy around the doll. And so people, you know, believe that Robert is plenty of things, either, you know, whatever, everybody has their interpretations of Robert, but this energy that was projected onto the doll, I think that's the base of the story of how Robert got to Key West. And I'm sure you have follow up questions.
Oh, we do.
Yes,
yeah. For that, so I don't want to give away everything right
all
now.
The
so,
I was, well, what are some of the odd events that have surrounded the doll?
And maybe, if you don't mind, can we do like what kind of odd events happened while Robert had the doll, and then maybe split that into before and after Robert was no longer in the picture?
The boy started going by Gene, so that might add some clarity to whatever we, I guess, discuss from now forward. I'll just call him, the boy will be Gene and the doll will be Robert. So that will hopefully lessen the confusion. Right. You know, his family was, and I think it's a very, it's a different time when obviously Gene was a little boy. So I'm not sure that any of the stories the initial stories about the doll, aside from the odd relationship that people felt that Gene and Robert had, I don't think there's many stories like early on about goings on in the house. Most of the things start coming out later on in life. And I think that is a time frame issue. I mean, people just didn't really divulge their personal business and talk about things like this, especially really early 20th century. So a lot of the stories about Robert and the problems that people felt that Robert was causing kind of came out, I'd say, probably in like 1920s. People would say they would, you know, hear noises in the house, and they would hear Gene talk to the doll, but they would hear in a different voice the doll answer him. That's usually what the family remembers the most about the early relationship that Gene and Robert had. Later on, Gene moved to France to study art. He was a really talented artist, wanted to follow this as his life's passion, went to France, studied art, and stayed away for a while because he had met what was to be his future wife. And so he returned as an adult. He'd left teenager late or early 20s, and then had come back and had been married. So the situation, I think, it kind of escalated more once Eugene returned to Key West with his wife. and took possession of the house. And that's when things started getting a little bit more pronounced. I think neighbors took notice. And obviously with other people, non-family members living in the house, i.e. Jean's wife, I think that that sort of prompted a little bit more hubbub about the relationship and potentially what was going on. A lot of it was two different voices coming from a room that only contained Eugene and Robert. So that, I think, was one of their big concerns, and that was something that circulated around Key West the most. People would be at the house, and they would say they would hear footsteps in rooms that were said to be vacant. Some people said they would see Robert in one window in the house and in a different window, you know, within a couple of minutes, and nobody was in the room. So how would he have moved if nobody was there? So, but possibly just on his own. So I think that was a lot of the strange goings on in the house.
So was there malice, do you think, in the activities at that point, or was it just bizarre? I mean,
I think it's more bizarre, and I don't know. I mean, I should probably just say that, you know, I've tried to learn about, and obviously I'm, for what I do, I look for facts.
Nice.
For things and trying to understand. Well, you know, being a historian, we kind of rely on that. So there's a lot of speculation, a lot of stories, and you can find, you know, so many things on the internet about Robert, and these, you know, it goes from docile to completely, you know, insane. Yeah. What you can find out there about him and what people have written and said that they've experienced or they heard this happened. And there's lots of different stories about how he was created. And I think that if you dial back to what Robert really is, and where he was from, I mean, there's stories about him being possessed or having voodoo because he was made by a Bahamian servant working for the Otto family. Well, I know that's not true because he is a Steiff doll. We've had multiple discussions with Steiff's company historians that have validated that Robert is part of a series that was done in the year that he was purchased for Eugene Otto. So, you know, once okay. you kind of remove those voodoo stories, a lot of the more crazy antics, I think, also become removed as well, because it's the same folks and the same bits of information that are basing it on voodoo that have like the more, oh, Robert, you know, sets things on fire. Well, you know, we've never found anything to substantiate any of that. Nobody's ever called and complained that Robert has set their house on fire or people. I mean, one story was a person was set on fire by Robert and they had to run to the ocean and jump in to put themselves out. I mean, it's it's borders on a little insanity.
Yeah, that, you know, straw men typically avoid fire. I don't know what he's stuffed with, but, you know.
yeah, usually they do.
Well, that's interesting.
So it really depends, I think, on what version of the story you're listening to and what has actually been complained about. I mean, a lot of people complain about him, and there's definitely people that lived in Key West that have been interviewed that felt uncomfortable in the house, felt a very uncomfortable spirit. What that is attributed to, I mean, obviously to Robert, yes, but what exactly it is, I mean, is it malice? Is it just a bit of bizarre behavior? Is it a child impish-like behavior to do mischief? You know, people have their own theories, and it's, you know, I think it probably dials back from malice specifically. Because they seem to be more outrageous stories that nobody can actually substantiate. So the museum likes to say, or we think he has, there's obviously an energy about him. That's an absolute. What that energy is and how it affects different people, I think it depends on people's attitudes toward Robert, how they treat him, and then what response they get from him varies, because some people have a very good experience with them. Some people have horrible experiences and say, you know, terrible things happen as soon as they leave him. So it's, you know, I think it's all in his interpretation of the encounter and the experience.
Well, it's very interesting to hear that Robert was part of a series. I wonder if there are other Robert the Dolls in existence somewhere else.
Well, there are. There is one. Basically, what he was he was made for Stipe. They made smaller versions of Robert. But, I mean, Robert wasn't made as a Robert. He was made as a court jester. That's this series was very circus-like, court jestery. He would have originally had on something similar to a court jester with a multicolored, almost harlequin look to him, rosy cheeks, a hat on. There was another one that the Stipe company historian came across. Robert would have been a window decoration alongside other dolls of the same size. They were just meant as a window display, and then Stipe was selling much smaller versions for sale. So we think, and the Stipe historian has kind of led us, I mean, that's where we've learned a lot about the origins of the doll. We think that because the family was very well off and because it was meant for a birthday present, that either the series was ending and they were going to change out the window display, that those dolls became available, or somebody came in and just offered a lot of money for the doll because they wanted to bring it back. So there are other dolls, not very many of that size. Most of them are much smaller, and by appearance you honestly wouldn't recognize them. You know, Robert's face has faded quite a bit over the years, so like he's lost his rosy cheeks, and he would have had color, like, not, I want to say lipstick because it seems not nice to say, but he would have had some color in his lips where he doesn't now, so a lot of that stuff has faded away. Sure, but he would have been a court jester stroke harlequin.
That's interesting because a lot of people think that he's a sailor from the outfit, what's left of it.
Yeah, that is an outfit that Eugene had to have put on him. And we think that was probably Eugene's own clothing from when he was younger.
He's that big.
Yeah, no, he's the size of a 4-year-old child. Yeah, I mean, incredible. He's almost 4 feet tall. Yeah, that's not an original costume for him. That would have been, we think it was probably Gene Otto's. There's a picture that his Gene's sister had, Elspeth, I think her name is, of Gene in a sailor suit, and he's kind of far in the distance, so we've tried to make it looks very, very similar in appearance. So we think that was probably at one point Gene's clothing that then he put on the doll.
I'm just delighted that you're sort of popping the balloon of some of these stories right off the bat, because that's kind of where our show tends to skew. But I from a historical perspective, I'm wondering, these stories themselves, are they mostly from an oral tradition, or is there actually written testimony of anyone who saw something strange, newspaper stories, or any, like, what historical documentation do you have for this sort of attitude that there was something bizarre about the doll, or the relationship that Robert had, or well, Eugene had with the doll?
Some people are still alive. I mean, Gene only died in the 70s.
Yeah.
So there are still a lot of folks who, you know, lived here, very longstanding families in this town. I mean, in fact, the neighbor that lived across the street from the Ottos, they've owned that house for, you know, 40, 50 years. I mean, they remember Anne still being alive and living there. I mean, the guy across the street was very good friends with Anne, who was Jean's wife. So they remember them very vividly. I mean, he's very elderly now. But there's always been an interest in Robert, and especially when he came to the museum in the 90s, I think people started digging around for information. I mean, there's the people that purchased Gene Otto's house after he passed away and Anne left the premises, they inherited the doll because the doll was still in the house. Anne did not take the doll with her when she moved. And the son of the people that purchased the house is still alive. And I mean, he remembers things. So, you know, while he doesn't remember Gene specifically, he lived in the same house with Robert for a time before his mother donated the doll to the museum. So he felt something. So, you know, we have people that we can probe for information on Robert, their experiences with Robert, what they remember. I mean, of course, there was some newspaper, but that was later on after Gene died. I think people always thought him to be an odd duck. And when he died, I think a lot of people started becoming more vocal about how bizarre they felt his behavior was. He moved in pretty influential circles because his family had money, but also because he was a very accomplished artist. And Anne was actually a concert pianist. I think she played in New York, and they wrote music together. So they were, they moved in quite affluent circles. And so, you don't find that people are very vocal about the affluent. It's only after they die they start making comments, because of course they don't want to fall out of favor with their friends who have money, so they would never, typically say something negative. Right. So, you're finding a lot of these stories later on after Jean died and the house changed hands and, Robert was moving into, with a different family. And then ultimately with the museum. So that's when a lot of this comes out. But a lot of people do remember and they're still alive.
So is there a book in the works at all? Because it sounds like it would be interesting while these people are still alive to get their stories and to – because you have certainly a lot more information than you can find online. A lot of it seems to be just folklore and myth.
Yeah. David Sloan, who run the ghost tour in Key West, he actually started the original ghost tour because Key West is – I guess by all intents and purposes, considered quite haunted. There's quite a lot of houses. There was, we bouts of yellow fever, so we had huge losses of life at times. So David Sloan actually started a ghost tour company down here. I would say, I don't even know when he did that, probably the mid-90s. And David always had some affinity for Robert. He was, when Robert got donated to the museum, David was very interested in finding out a lot about the doll, and has actually, I think it's been about 2 years, the book's been out now. David wrote a book. We gave him access to a lot of our archival material, and he did the legwork. The museum is just, we're a small museum. We don't have the manpower to do that. And David and I have known each other for years. So it made sense for David to take the lead on that to find things. So he spent, days at the library, contacting family members, contacting folks who would have remembered Jean and Anne living down here, and interviewing people and asking for photographs. So David did a lot of legwork, and David did put out a book, must be almost 2 years ago now.
Okay.
That David did. So he did, and it's not something the museum could have undertaken. So we were happy, and we gave him access to anything that we had to make sure that the book was as thorough as possible.
We'll put a link in the show notes. I know people who actually are quite afraid of Robert, or very deferential to him, even from afar. And I wonder, there's this habit of sending letters of apology or something like that. Can you explain that or talk about that? Or what's that about?
Sure. I think this goes back to people's experiences, and everybody who interacts with Robert, whether it's, some people don't even interact with him in person. Some people feel that they've interacted with him online by learning his story or watching videos on YouTube or wherever they can find them. And each person obviously has a very different experience with Robert. And they, whatever it is, Robert, I suppose, I don't know. This is something that's been longstanding even before I was at the museum. Apology letters started filtering in from folks who had visited and felt that they had done something incorrect to Robert and needed to apologize to something because they were experiencing a string of bad luck, and that varied in the degree. I mean, sometimes it was just as simple as our flights were delayed when we were leaving Key West to, okay, we came home from Key West and we found like a dead bat in our washing machine. Just weird things. And so we get letters, emails, people contact him on his, Robert has his own Facebook page and his own Twitter page. So people contact him any way that they can from all over the world and just apologize or want to know why they're having bad luck because they just watched a video or felt that they were very respectful to Robert when they visited, but they still are having these horrible things happen to them. And want Robert to lift whatever it is, whatever negative energy is surrounding these people. So we get all sorts of letters and, I mean, phone call, people call, you know, it's incredible.
Isn't there a particular protocol that some people believe in for taking photographs of him?
Yeah, there is, and people are meant to ask permission of Robert to take his photo. He doesn't, he's classically not enjoyed his photo being taken. He has really messed with people's cameras. The Travel Channel was down, and they actually, their main camera that they brought with them broke, so they had to use their backup camera to film him. Mysteries at the Museum, I think it was.
Okay.
Had come down and done it from the Travel Channel. And, you know, their camera was messed up. So these are professional people that know how to operate their equipment. So they actually all sent apology letters to Robert after they left because they were completely convinced that Robert had done something to their equipment. So,
well, it sounds like Robert owes them an apology.
I'm not sure that's how it works. I think it's the other way around.
Can you apologize via Twitter, or does it strictly have to be a letter, or how does that work?
I mean, like, in this day and age, I think Robert has to be slightly adaptable to people's apologies. And like I said, sometimes it comes from people that have never even met him. I mean, he has a woman in Indonesia who believes that Robert is going to come kill her and her family and sends things privately. That's not something the museum would necessarily share. Like, her letters are not, you know, we try to be selective with what we put out there because I think people feel that they are really writing to Robert and put anything out, on the internet. It's not necessarily something that they would like because it's a private letter to an entity. And so, you know, we have this person in Indonesia who is completely apparently convinced. And so she emails him at least 3 or 4 times a day and has done for, the last 5 or 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then actually went to the museum social media page, started emailing to the point that, you know, the museum staff who checks the social media said, oh my God, you know, do we need to be concerned about this because of the tone? So, and she's never met him. She's never left Indonesia. So, I mean, he's very far reaching. So he gets messages from people who, I don't have access or don't have the ability. I mean, there's no way that she can write this many letters per day and actually post them. So, you know, the museum is adaptable to how he receives any kind of correspondence.
Right, yeah. He's got a Facebook page too, doesn't he? Thousands of likes.
Yeah, he does. He's got his own. Yeah, he does. Well, he does.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Fortunate, I guess they don't have an unlike button, right? So, I mean, no one can offend him too much on Facebook.
Wait, got an angry button.
I guess.
Yeah, some people say things that they don't believe in him on his, you know, Facebook page. And, you know, Robert typically doesn't have to respond to any of that because anybody else who's very supportive of Robert and follows him will just take up take up the
he's
charge.
Got, he's got his own defenders, defend him. Right?
Yeah,
he does. He really does. People just, you know, they gravitate toward him, good and bad.
So Robert has been in the museum a while now, and then he was on that TV show with Zach Bagans.
Yeah.
Right. So what was that like?
Interesting.
Okay.
Interesting. Robert never left Florida after he arrived. We cannot find any documentation that once Gene's family members brought Robert to Florida that Robert has ever left the state of Florida since. And so Travel Channel reached out to us asking if we would be keen on this, bringing Robert to this program. And you know, we were obviously very apprehensive about doing that because, you know, he's fragile. And, you know, from the angle that I have to come at it, I'm the curator. I have to make sure that if objects are moving around, that they are very well protected, that they're safe to do that, that they're in such a fragile condition, you know, never mind that he's in a very humid environment and I'm taking him to a very dry environment, right, of Las Vegas, that we're not compromising a museum artifact, because I know all of us are guilty of it. Even at the museum, we refer to Robert as a human, you know, we call him, we don't call it. But you know, I have to have some realization that Robert actually is a museum artifact. And so he has to be treated as such. So that was our big concern. And the Travel Channel people were super about it. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, I know they, of course, they have an angle about what they were wanting to portray Robert as and what we were what they were hoping to get, their viewership to believe about him. And, you know, it was an interesting experience. I'm sure, you know, we get a lot of PR traction out of it for the museum and for Robert. So, I mean, we saw his Facebook numbers jump and people were paying a lot more attention, and people were calling the museum to tell us how upset, because they thought, you know, they just saw Robert in Las Vegas and they just thought the museum had sold him, or our museum had moved him to Vegas permanently. And we got some really, rude correspondence from people and phone calls saying, how dare we, you know, how dare we move him to Vegas, and how he's meant to be in Key West, and how we're all going to be cursed because of it. So it was really, I found that probably more fascinating than anything, were people's response to Robert leaving Key West, even if it was only temporary.
He was going to get his own Vegas act.
I was going to say, and whatever's cursed in Vegas stays in Vegas, so that's all good.
Yeah, right. Well, we made sure a lot of it hit his social media pages. I actually got him. We took him because he's huge. To be fair, you know, he's this of a size of a child. So, we took him into one of the casinos and asked if we can actually put him at a slot machine and take his photo.
Nice.
And, yeah, because, you know, when in Vegas, he might as well. And it was absolutely insane. People, I had to go talk to the pit boss about it, and we had to have security around us because, you know, the guy said, you have a what? Because he traveled in a body bag effectively. So he could, I mean, really, he was in a big suit bag because we couldn't take the chance of anybody spilling anything on him. Mm-hmm. So we walked into the casino with, you know, holding like a kid, a body bag. And so people obviously are staring at you and they're going, what is going on?
How did he do? Did he do okay?
No, he wasn't allowed to play.
What?
Oh. That was the rule. We could only take a photo. Well, he's quite overage, I think, because he wasn't, if he, God forbid, you know, he won.
True.
Good
true,
point.
Then I guess the IRS probably couldn't come after him for his winnings, their share of the winnings. So they said just, you know, a couple photos, and the pit boss had to stand behind us, and we had security flanking us to make sure that nobody came up to us, and we didn't actually do anything that who knows what we're up to. I mean, what a great story. Sure, I'm carrying a haunted doll around and he's playing slot machines. I mean, that could have been some kind of ridiculous story to do something else. So we were heavily guarded when we were there.
So you were talking about the agendas of these TV shows and the angles that they take. Do you feel like there's a lot of pressure for you guys there at the museum to play up the supernatural aspects of Robert's story?
I think so. I think so. And I, you know, and of course we have to be very conscientious of not putting people off because, you know, it's we're the museum has to deal in fact, but we also don't want to discourage people feeling that the way, you know, the way that they would naturally feel. So, you know, we do not say for anybody, like whatever our personal beliefs are, whether or not, I mean, there's staff members who really believe in Robert and talk to him all the time when they're in the museum. And there are staff members that just say, you know, really, this is, it, you know, it's a doll. So, right. you know, we can't let our personal beliefs come into that and what the museum allows out there. I mean, you know, my take on it is there has to be something to it because all these people can't be wrong. I mean, he's contacted by so many individuals talking about so many things and how he affects so many people's lives. Like who is the museum to say yes or no, mm-hmm. that you're right or wrong? So the museum has to be very ambiguous, but we certainly will not make up something just to follow through with an agenda, let's say, for a program like that. I mean, we've been contacted by a lot of programs. I don't want to single them out like they're right. the only ones. Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, he's been to paranormal conference and, you know, I know that they were some people there were very much trying to push something. And then the other people were just like, okay, I'm just curious and I want to learn something. So, you know, we just try to be very middle of the road and let people make their own decisions.
I'm sure it can be a good gateway to history in many ways too.
Yeah, I think so.
Would people still come see Robert if Eugene had just been an adult with an attachment to a doll? I mean, like if he had a mundane doll history, except that his owner had been peculiar without the supernatural elements.
I, you know, who knows? I don't know what the fascination is for people. I can't say. I mean, some people are attracted to the Robert story, the Eugene story more because I don't know if it's something that they can identify with. I don't know if it's like a lonely little boy thing that people, you know, growing up and you have an attachment to, you know, other people or objects. So some people find the fascination in the attachment. And not necessarily Robert, where other people are just fascinated by the supernatural and by Robert. And, you know, who I don't know. I don't know what. And people come to the museum specifically because they don't believe in Robert. And they just want to prove something that nothing will happen to them.
I see.
So, you know, who knew? I can't really say whether or not people would still come. I think that they would. Mm-hmm. Because they do now for all sorts of reasons. So if the circumstance changed, but Robert was still on display, yeah, of course people would probably come see him because they still have their own justifications for that and reasonings to visit Robert.
This is kind of not really a follow-up, but I just thought of it. I want to ask, is anyone who has been interviewed about what they've heard with Robert and Eugene talking to each other, did they describe the voice that they heard? I'm just curious whether it was the voice of, you know, how sometimes kids, you know, or even like almost like a ventriloquism, or was it a completely different alien, you know, I don't mean like from another planet, I mean alien as in not the voice mm-hmm. of Eugene. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I don't know David Sloan, again, who's the one who authored the book on Robert, carried out those interviews. I sat in on a couple of them. And he taped them, so he shared some of those with me. I don't remember if it was mentioned. I don't remember personally, and I know he interviewed people that heard either Robert talking or Eugene throwing his voice, whichever the case is that you believe. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. David would be a better person to ask for that. I'm not sure what the voice would have sounded like. I mean, for the fact that people would follow up to say that they thought there were two people in the room, my gut instinct is that the voice was quite different. Because wouldn't you just think it was Eugene talking to himself if the voice was similar?
Yeah, yeah. And certainly when these stories are passed on, they become embellished and it's very difficult to know what really happened.
Right.
So you were talking about Eugene's art and how accomplished and well-known he was and is. Do you actually have any of his artworks on display in the museum?
We don't. We own some of his artwork. We don't have it on display. Some of the pieces, we think it's probably best security wise that they're not, because they're smaller and people are in the, we would never accuse anybody, but you know, we certainly are more cautious with Eugene's artwork because of its size and because of the information circulating around about Robert. And if somebody had an attachment to Robert, which they do, I mean, he gets love letters and presents and all sorts of things. So the museum feels that it's probably for the best that we don't leave original artwork out. Okay. Because the museum is busy, but it's not fully, I mean, it's supervised, but it's not like we don't have security guards in that room 24 hours a day.
I think we'd actually like to talk a little bit about the museum itself too, but I have one more sort of Robert question, which is, I've heard that Chucky from Child's Play was based on Robert. Do you know if there's any truth to that?
No, absolutely not. Even I don't remember the director's name of the film. I mean, he even came up because he's obviously been asked this question over and over again, and he said no.
Awesome.
That's really interesting.
He said no. And I know David tried to follow up with him when he was writing the book, because that's something that David and I have like a real bugbear about is this. And I understand, I get it, because they're dolls and they have owners, and you know, Chucky killed people and Robert didn't, but I understand it being based on something. But even the movie's director has come out and said, no, there's no basis for that. Yeah, I know it's out. I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, people, it is. And there's, you know, the museum says it isn't, but you know, there's plenty of other websites that do so.
Okay, well, we wanted to ask you a bit more about the museum. So what kind of work does curating a museum entail?
I'm responsible for all the objects in our collection and writing all of the didactic information that gets put out there, as well as doing the displays. So kind of a lot.
Yeah, keeps you busy.
It keeps me extremely busy. So that's kind of my job in a nutshell, and doing all sorts of dealing with inquiries, and it's fascinating work. I mean, Robert is one of, you know, we probably have at least 30,000 objects in the collection. So he's one of, he's a big responsibility because he's one of our more well-known objects. So he does get, we have a bias toward him because, of course, you know, he is more special than some of the other ones. He is pretty special. So we do have a bias, but that's my job usually.
What sort of other objects do you have in the museum? What notable historical type things? What do you like to highlight besides Robert?
Well, so Robert is in 40 Smartello Museum. The historical society that I work for, actually, we have three museums. So Robert is at the Fort. There are, we tend to, each one has its own identity. Each of the museum sites has its own identity. We run the lighthouse as well, so that has a completely separate identity and attracts a completely different set of visitors. And then we operate another museum that's the Museum of Art and History of Key West. So there's a little bit of crossover between the Fort and the Museum of Art and History. So each one, we try to highlight different objects in each place because, let's say, for instance, the lighthouse attracts people that are more interested in, you know, military history usually, or nautical history, or you know, people just love lighthouses, so they go there. A lot of visitors to the Fort are really interested in Robert. I mean, he is one of the big drives for people to go to the Fort. I mean, there's a lot of other objects there, and that's what we tend to find with visitors. They'll come for Robert, and they learn so much more because we try to talk about the history of Key West in there, in that museum. We talk about all the different industries. The museum itself is a Civil War era fort that was used through the Civil War. It was used through the Spanish-American War. They used it during World War I and II. They also, because Key West is the closest to Cuba, when there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, that fort is the closest building to, or one of the closest buildings to Cuba. So when Kennedy actually came to Key West during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, there was a lot going on at the fort militarily. So people liked that fort in particular because of its military draw. So we highlight a lot of that history. what that also means is it, when you have a military history, especially Civil War, and especially before disease prevention and disease control was much more mainstream, a lot of the soldiers that were stationed in Key West, you know, died because we're in a very tropical environment. Yellow fever outbreaks happened a lot, and they would quarantine at the fort. So I think there's always been this idea of death and a little bit of a darkness surrounding it. And so Robert was a natural fit for the fort when he was donated because it kind of had that connotation anyway. And I think a lot of it is because of the history. I mean, history, you're looking in the past, it's gone. So it has that sort of air of not being here anymore because it's like industries that are defunct. So you have, I think, that kind of that same mindset. So Robert was a natural fit to be out there. And then other objects started filtering in. I mean, once you have, I guess, one haunted object, everybody calls you to donate or talk to you about other objects. Actually, before Robert was there, we had a donation, I think it was in the 50s, maybe early 1960s, of a horse-drawn hearse from the funeral parlor down here, one of them down here. The funeral director donated it because they obviously moved into a vehicle for their funeral processions, and they had this horse-drawn hearse that had carried, you know, God knows how many bodies, and that was donated to us in the 60s. So we've always had that as an organization, and that's always been on display. Then we had Robert. Then there's a very, really creepy, horrible story about a guy that stole a woman out of the Key West Cemetery. The marker, because there was no headstone per se, because it was an entire above ground mausoleum built for her. There was a marble sign that had her name on it and her birth date and her death date. And when the mausoleum exploded, somebody salvaged this plaque, this sign, marble stone sign, and the museum actually has it. They donated it to the museum.
So I'm curious, has anyone ever offered to buy Robert?
Absolutely. We've had phone calls from people offering, insane amounts of money for, truthful or not, who knows? I don't know. I usually get lucky enough to field these phone calls and, $1 billion. Okay.
But sure. He's not for sale.
Yeah, he's not for sale. He's a museum object. You know, we're not in the habit of selling museum objects. We had a woman call saying that she was Eugene Otto's daughter, and she wanted the doll. And I said, okay, obviously I'll entertain the phone conversation. So I said, oh, okay, so what are you proposing? And she said, a whole bunch of numbers. And I just said, well, they didn't have children, so I don't know how, you're possibly the daughter if they didn't have children. And so then she said something really nasty to me on the phone, told me I would be cursed and hung up on me. So,
wow.
we get all sorts. I mean, I don't think we've ever had a legitimate offer for Robert that people can follow through with, but we get a lot of phone calls allegedly offering to purchase him.
Well, if we go to Key West and want to see the museum, I mean, you said there's more than, you've actually got three locations, but can you buy like one pass and it covers all three, or how does that work?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you can.
Great. Okay.
Got to get out there someday.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I've always wanted to go down there. There seems like there's a lot of things to see. So that sounds neat.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
there's a beach too, apparently. If you haven't heard that, that's a...
just one.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough living here.
Isn't there that interesting cemetery as well with all of the witty epitaphs and some strange museum down
there
in Key West?
Key West Cemetery is, I think it's one of the most underrated things to do down here. You go to places like New Orleans and they have special tours all the time for, and people are just so engaged with the cemeteries, and here they do as good a job as they can because it's still an operational cemetery, so they can't do like regular tours, and they just encourage people to go through on their own. And they have wonderful maps online. Just they don't want to, you know, disrupt services or tell people, you know, run tours while families are grieving. So, you know, they encourage you to do it on your own. And I don't know that enough people do that. I mean, there's some really hilarious headstones. There's some really interesting people that are buried here. And you have, I think one of the more fascinating aspects of it is, and it kind of, I think speaks to Key West, in general, historically is, you know, you've got everybody's in one cemetery. So you've, you know, you have the Jewish population, you have the Catholic population, you have blacks, you have whites, you have Hispanics. I mean, they're all buried in and amongst each other. So it's a really neat, I think, cultural comment, but also I think it gives you a really good idea of who lived here and a lot of the history in Key West and some of the humor that goes with it. I mean, somebody has their pet deer. Actually, the Otto family has their deer buried with them. They had a pet deer.
Wow.
And they had, you know, somebody has on there, a woman wrote, like, "See, I told you I was sick" on her headstone. So there's lots of little funny.
That's really funny. But, you know,
quirky.
I think it's kind of lamentable that, to some degree, a lot of these ghost hunting TV shows seem to have played up the idea of, you know, haunted graveyards. And cemeteries, I think, historically, they're places where you remember the people, and it's historical. You remember the history of the people. People you might not know, you might stop and see something interesting and, like, want to find out more about that person who did this thing or who was remembered for this thing, or at least think about them, right? And in the context that they had and, the you know, all the other things that come with that, which, you know, the brevity of life and so on. But they're underrated. They're underrated. I think our listeners probably like them, but, you know.
Well, I think a lot of them were historically treated as parks, and
they were,
and people would go there and have lunch, and so they they didn't quite have the stigma that they often have today. Corey, we have a question that we like to ask all of our guests, so our final question, and that is, what's your favorite monster?
I don't know. There's just so many to pick from. I would say, I don't know, since I'm a historian, I think I'm a little old school, and I would just stick to, like, a good classic, like Frankenstein.
Nice. He can't go wrong. I mean.
Yeah. I think I'm just, you know, I like to keep it simple, and I like to
I don't think we've had
historical.
Frankenstein before, so that's good.
Well, I think someone will throw something at their iPod if I don't say, well, technically Frankenstein was not the monster. But, you know, it depends on how you look at it, and certainly within the Hammer films and their interpretation of it, the Dr. Frankenstein did become the monster in many ways. But I actually just came back from watching Young Frankenstein on a special one night big screen presentation last night. The whole idea of reanimating the dead, it ties in nicely with this episode anyway.
Mm-hmm. So definitely.
I think it's a great choice.
Yeah, excellent.
Well, thanks.
But yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show. We've been talking about wanting to do a Robert the Doll show for years now. So we're very, very happy, and we're really excited about this one.
And thank you so much for your work in preserving history and making it available to people. That's really important.
Yeah, thank you. That's really what we do it for. You know, working for a nonprofit's not always the most glorious. So, you know, it's things and just getting the out there and getting people to learn really makes the job so much more rewarding.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Dr. Corey Convertito about Robert the Doll and his strange history. As you heard, there's a particular atmosphere surrounding Robert in his exhibit at Key West. Corey called it an energy, but I want to talk a little bit about that idea. In his book, The Science of Superstition, psychology professor Bruce Hood tells about a fascinating experiment in which people were asked to try on a sweater. It's a simple experimental idea. Would people be willing to try on a clean sweater from a stranger? Most people wouldn't mind. But when Bruce tells them that the sweater belonged to a notorious serial killer, suddenly, few people are willing to touch the sweater. Why? It's because we have an idea of tainted items. The things we experience, even the way we rate the quality of food and drink, is heavily influenced by expectation and mood and a number of complicated feelings beyond the immediate visceral act of experiencing whatever it is we're trying. A big idea in the study of superstition is that people attribute agency to particular patterns of events and sensations.
Superstitions come from the very powerful effect of our brain finding patterns and matching them to a particular cause. If you wear green socks and your team wins, and then you wear green socks again later and your team wins, it's the socks. It couldn't be the skill of the players or the random variations that happen during a game. No, clearly your footwear choices are really the deciding factor. What else could explain it? Okay, that's a silly example, but that's the kind of stuff that superstition's made of. There's a mental effect called confirmation bias, which comes up again and again when we research why people believe bizarre and unlikely things. Confirmation bias is a tendency to see things which confirm your belief, and to ignore things which don't match the pattern. If you've ever lived with someone who frequently left the seat up on the toilet, you might find yourself thinking, he always leaves the seat up. Yet what if sometimes he doesn't? Would you notice? Why would you? That's not the pattern you're looking for. Attribution is a big challenge in researching the paranormal. When something peculiar happens, was it caused by aliens? Was it a ghost? Could it have been demons? Did anything even really happen? If something did happen, was it really peculiar? This whole problem of attribution, who or what caused that strange event or that unusual feeling, is something to consider very closely when thinking about Robert the Doll. And another important psychological effect is called priming, the setting of expectations, whether consciously or unconsciously, before an encounter takes place. Just like listening to creepy music and seeing other scary trailers primes you for an experience at a horror film, imagine hearing legends and lore surrounding this doll Robert before finally coming to see him on display. Robert isn't just a doll in a museum, and he's not just adorned with a sailor outfit and filled with straw. Robert is decorated with thousands of stories and more than a century of lore. He's stuffed with meaning as much as he's stuffed with straw. I don't think it's surprising that people find Robert frightening, but I hope that listening to these ideas and perhaps reading some of the material I've linked to will help you see that there are many very plausible reasons to be skeptical of Robert's alleged supernatural powers. No disrespect intended to Robert, of course. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views you've heard on this show are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. If you'd like to see the reflected views of Skeptic Magazine, you'll need to get a silver mirror and creep into the darkness of a graveyard by moonlight. And then, next to the big vaulted tomb, put your back to the entrance, look into the mirror, and mutter, "Michael Shermer," 3 times. Or you could just buy the magazine at your local newsstand or subscribe at skeptic.com. It's your call.
Here's a quick reminder about a huge skeptics conference coming up in October. The Committee for Skeptical Inquiry is hosting PsyCon 2016 in Las Vegas. Go to csiconference.org for more details. But the guest list is amazing. You got James Randi, Massimo Polidoro, Elizabeth Loftus, Ray Hyman, Joe Nickel, Eugenie Scott, Lawrence Krauss. Look, the list is just full of awesome people. Go check it out. That's csiconference.org in Las Vegas, October 27th through the 30th, 2016. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms.
Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Steely Monkeys. The introduction segment's music is the song Creepy Doll by Jonathan Colton. Stay tuned after the outro to hear the full version of that amazing song. Thanks again for listening.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
In a town in the woods at the top of a hill, there's a house where no one lives. So you take a big bag of your big city money there and buy it. But at night when the house is dark and you're all alone, there's a noise upstairs. At the top of the stairs there's a door and you take a deep breath and try it. And the flashlight shows you something moving just inside the door. There's a tattered dress and a feeling you have felt somewhere before. And there's a creepy doll that always follows you. It's got a ruined eye, it's always open. And there's a creepy doll that always follows you. It's got a pretty mouth. It was just a dream. In the morning you head into town, cause you wanna go antiquing. In the store there's a strange old man with a wandering eye and a withered hand. When he hands you the old wooden box, you can hear his old bones creaking. And you know what you will find inside the moment that you see that someone carved your name into the tarnished silver key. And there's a creepy doll that always follows you. It's got a ruined eye, it's always open. And there's a creepy doll that always follows you. It's got a pretty mouth, swallow you whole. When you come home, can't sleep, so you make some tea. And the doll disapprovingly asks if you really need that much honey. You decide that you've had enough and you lock the doll in the wooden box. You put the box in the fireplace next to your bag of big city money. As the smoke fills up your tiny room, there's nothing you can do. Far too late.